This is the Chris DeGaulle Show podcast.
Okay, guys, let's just rip. And Chris DeGaulle.
Chris DeGaulle. Chris, thanks for being with me tonight.
Chris DeGaulle.
I'm joined now by Chris DeGaulle.
Now, as downloadable as he is lovable, it's Chris DeGaulle.
Presented by Harvey Durham Insurance. Save big money monthly and get better health coverage at HarveyDurham.com.
I don't know what it was about yesterday. I mean, I'm grateful. I always think they're home runs, right? I was getting more email yesterday from people that said, I don't know what it was, Stigholm, something in your coffee yesterday. You were exceptional yesterday. Well, I agree, but as opposed to other days? See if I can replicate it. No, a guy emailed me yesterday, said from start to finish the entire show, you should make that a demo reel, he said. In the business, it must be somebody from the business. That's lingo in the business for when you're shopping for other jobs. Put together a demo reel. That is your highlights, the best of your work to shop around to other employers when you're looking for a job. So I thought, does this guy know something I don't, Fast Eddie? He said, you should put yesterday's show on your demo reel. Am I looking for work and I haven't been told?
I was going to say, are you breaking news this morning? What the heck?
I hope not. So the news broke yesterday that Sloppy Choppers has COVID. It was after we concluded the show here. Sloppy Choppers has COVID, and worse still, ladies and gentlemen, Sloppy Choppers has COVID, and she got close to the stupid old man we're supposed to pretend is president. We're back to doing Zapruder film analysis of COVID in the room. From Politico, COVID creeps ever closer to Biden. Standing before a packed White House crowd this week, President Joe Biden cheerfully ticked off a series of his administration's health care accomplishments. Among them, he said, finally getting the coronavirus under control. Yet, as Biden waded through the celebratory East Room, embracing and shaking hands with dozens of maskless lawmakers and advocates, the virus was quietly running rampant through the building. In the space of a week, dozens of White House aides and federal officials have contracted the disease in an outbreak that appears to have touched all corners of the administration. Two cabinet members have it, along with a growing list of congressional Democrats. Vice President Kamala Harris, who stood next to Biden on Tuesday. She didn't stand next to him. She ran him over. She stood in front of him. She ignored him. Stood next to him. No, I love how they write this as though Joe Biden was in the room. Look, Joe Biden is so diminished in that East Room event this week, even coronavirus ignored him. Vice President Kamala Harris, standing next to Biden Tuesday, has had her communications staff hit by COVID. Oh, well, God forbid. If ever there's a group of people we're terribly worried about not being able to do their jobs, it's Vice President Kamala Harris's communication staff. COVID can only help her communication staff by stopping them. Thursday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi tested positive just a day after appearing alongside the president. The outbreak has jolted a Washington establishment that's been eager to leave COVID behind and offered an up-close reminder of the pandemic threat that still hangs over the nation and Biden's presidency. It's also raised fresh questions about how best to protect the 79-year-old commander-in-chief, who vowed this year to get out of the White House more often, yet faces an ever-present, elevated risk of severe illness. Are we doing this? I've asked this now 2 years in a row, and I guess I'll ask it again. Are we really doing this again? There is so much about this story that amazes me. Number one, talking about this diminished, feeble, old fool that we're supposed to pretend is president, as though he is one of our great, great elders in a nursing home, talking about him like he's a carton of fragile eggs that we're picking up at the grocery store and making sure not to stack anything on top of. This is the most powerful man in the world, and Politico is writing a story, how do we take care of Uncle Ned in his last days to make sure he doesn't get really sick? This is pathetic. And I want you to understand how pathetic this is for a host of reasons. It's pathetic. This is the President of the United States. How do we keep him safe from a virus? How to best protect the Commander-in-Chief, who vowed to get out more often? How do we keep him safe from an ever-present elevated risk of severe illness? How do we keep him safe from getting sick? What are we talking about? Have you ever heard anyone talked about this way? I mean, when you talk about the President of the United States staying safe and keeping him safe, you think, let's make sure he doesn't, God forbid, get assassinated. Let's make sure there's no explosive devices near him. Let's make sure we sweep. If you've ever been at a presidential event, you know the extraordinary security to keep him safe. You go through magnometers. They sweep the building with dogs. You stand in miles-long lines to get in a room to sit and watch the president speak. Those are the things you think when you think we've got to keep a president of the United States safe. This guy is so pathetic. Politico is openly wringing their hands, wondering if Gramps is going to catch a cold or not. What a feeble, frail old man that's been elected, air quotes, president of the United States. This is their biggest worry. Everybody's in danger, says Irwin Redlener, director of the Pandemic Resources and Response Initiative at Columbia University. It's almost impossible to isolate the President of the United States in a way that would keep him from getting sick. Yes, because getting sick is what we do. We all do. In fact, I think I'm coming down with the ravages of a common cold right now. It's annoying as hell. Last night I started feeling a little... We didn't have a family meeting and get my paperwork in order. I didn't tell the kids I loved them. Well, I told the kids I loved them, but I didn't say, Daddy might not wake up in the morning. I'm starting to feel the sniffles.
No.
Why are we still talking about this? Now, I want to remind you that just last week, I think, maybe this week, it all blends together. Didn't Grandpa make a big show about rolling up his sleeve and getting his 700th booster shot? That was an event.
Yes.
He came out and he said, get your shot, get another shot, shots here, more shots, who wants a shot? We just proved another shot. And then he rolled up his sleeve and they gave him another shot at the White House. That just happened. What was that, his fourth, fifth shot? What are we on now, fourth, fifth booster?
I think it probably was his fourth, I think.
How many shots? I mean, how many shots? Same with Circle Back Girl. She was out with COVID. How many shots? We've all had the shot. Shot, 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 shot. Five boosters, six boosters, seven boosters more. How many boosters? How many of these things do we have to take before this is not a crisis? Danger! Why are we still talking about this as though it's day one, 2020, people dying on cruise ships? Why are we still talking about it like this? And yet Politico is... They're openly wondering if the President of the United States is some sort of physical danger and that this is danger, not just catching it, quote, everyone's in danger. Do you feel in danger? I suppose there's still people in our population that believe they're in danger, but do you or do you think most of us feel we're in danger? I can tell you, I just attended an event last night in a ballroom full of people. Not a mask to be found, packed tightly in this ballroom, several hundred people, no masks, no discussion of COVID. In fact, the only discussion was, we haven't done this together in a room for 2 years, and we're so glad to be able to get back together and do it again. It was a private fundraising function that I attended, and hadn't happened for 2 years. The last one they did was in April of 2019. So this was the first time they had all gotten back together, and they were all thrilled to be together. No one felt in danger. And if you'd walked in the room and say, hey, you know, COVID's not over yet, just so you know, COVID's still hanging out there, there's danger. I would like to think most people in the room would roll their eyes and go, what are you talking about, danger? Like, we all understand what this is now, don't we? Or not?
I honestly, it goes back to Tom Wolfe. Like, they talk about the virus. Like, their words are very intentional. They talk about the virus as if it is a physical being out to get you.
Like a loose gunman.
Yes.
like an assassin
on
the prowl,
mm-hmm.
creating this element of looming fear coming from around a corner when you don't see it.
Exactly.
And that we can somehow catch it. If only we all band together somehow and do some sort of collective action, we can catch the assassin.
Right.
Which is absurd. Biden's ability to remain COVID-free to date has been the result of stringent White House protocols, careful travel, and so, well, he doesn't go anywhere. He goes to Wilmington every day. It's him, Jill, and Wilmington every day. Like, he doesn't do anything. Careful travel. I wouldn't catch anything either if I never, ever left my house. But COVID's creep toward the Oval Office underscores the delicate stage the administration has entered into its broader fight against the pandemic. After weathering multiple surges throughout the first year, Biden is now trying to claim a measure of victory, highlighting the plunge in COVID cases nationally and touting the array of vaccines and treatments developed to fight off the infection. That's exactly right. This is the guy that's been telling us we're supposed to get 3 trillion shots and making a big show of it all the time. Remember that Emerson Research, not Emerson, the Impact Research Group, remember that memo that went out? That told Democrats and the Biden people, it was a Democrat pollster firm, and they issued that memo that said, we got to stop talking about this. Like, we need to declare victory on this thing and move on. We've got to acknowledge that it's endemic, it's here to stay. Don't proclaim victory over it. Just say, hey, we've got the tools, let's move on. And I remind you, Title 42, this would be a good opportunity. We started the week with this. Let me end it with this. A bipartisan group of senators introduced a bill yesterday meant to force the Biden administration to delay ditching Title 42 health policy next month, warning that suspending the order will unleash a humanitarian crisis as thousands of illegals flock to the southern border. The proposal, backed by 5 Democrats and 6 Republicans, ladies and gentlemen, that's bipartisan. Remember, whenever Democrats are in charge and 1 Republican jumps ship and joins them, bipartisan support for the Democrat initiative, right? Well, this is 5 Democrats in a Democrat-controlled Congress who have joined with 6 Republicans who want to postpone doing away with Title 42. Kyrsten Sinema is back. Real thorn in the side of the Democrats these days down there in Arizona. Quote, Arizona communities bear the brunt of the federal government's failure at our border, so we're stepping in and protecting border communities by ensuring the administration works hand-in-hand with local leaders, law enforcement, and nonprofits to put a comprehensive, workable plan in place before lifting Title 42. Remember how I talked about this? Politicians talking about Title 42 as though it's strictly a border enforcement problem. It is, of course, but that's not the way you talk about it. Title 42 was implemented via the CDC and the Trump administration under what conditions? COVID conditions, when we're trying to mitigate the spread, slow the spread of COVID. The way you talk about this is the way Politico's talking about Joe Biden this morning. This is why I say it's play their game. It's terribly effective, Republicans, and I don't know why you're not playing it. I suppose because they don't want to sound like they're buying into the fear. Hit Democrats where they live with this. Do away with Title. Explain what Title 42 was meant to do. Don't get into this. First of all, there's total support across the board for border control anyway. So I know there's an element. Republicans are probably thinking, hey, we win on the issue of securing our border and stopping the free flow of illegals into the country. I understand Republicans think that's a winner anyway, and it is. But there's another element to it. There's apparently a whole audience in this country still that is hip deep and like up to the buffet with a feed bag of panic around their neck, and they just can't stop dining out on a steady diet of panic about COVID. I guess it's still real. I don't know who these people are. Are there the people still wearing masks? I don't know. And I don't mean to mock people. There are lots of reasons people decide to wear masks or whatever. I'm very intrigued. Sincerely, I want to ask people when I see them walking about in masks or driving in masks. I still see it. and it makes me want to ask them, what's going on? Like, I want to know, earnestly. Like, are you ill? Is there someone at home that's ill? Are you, everything's otherwise normal, but you're still very afraid of catching it? I'd really like to know. Do you think, how many people you see in masks today still have ordinary circumstances, meaning there's no one in their lives where they themselves are not immunocompromised. They're just genuinely still very afraid of catching the virus. What percentage of those people do you think are still out there? You think it's high? You think it's gone away?
I think it's low.
Very low?
Yeah, I mean...
So you think it's a fringe of people who genuinely just live in fear of catching this virus at this point?
Yes.
I hope you're right. I think you're right, too. I agree with that. So you think there's probably a contingency of people who aren't necessarily afraid of it themselves, but are afraid that their immunocompromised relative might catch it, and so they don't want to go... they don't want to exacerbate it by not wearing a mask or something. They may be doing their part, they feel like, to help protect their loved one.
Yeah.
Maybe there's that.
Uh-huh.
I think that's admirable. But the point is that person still believes that their loved one could die from COVID. Even if they themselves aren't afraid, they wear the mask because they're afraid someone they love might catch it and die, and they don't want to be the ones to give it, and so they adhere to the mask, thinking that will protect them from catching it. Okay, fine. I mean, I think there's a lot of science that says that's not going to work, but whatever. Now let's talk to that person. I want to go up to the person wearing the mask this morning at Wawa, and I want to say, excuse me, ma'am or sir, wearing the mask. Title 42 was enacted to immediately deport people who illegally cross our border. It was enacted through the Centers for Disease Control under the Trump administration to immediately deport anybody we've detained due to COVID because we have no way of screening properly and obviously properly vaccinating people that break into the country in the era of COVID, which spreads quickly. And based on your mask, I trust you're concerned about this issue. Do you agree with the concept of Title 42 that when we catch people illegally at the border, because of our concern of the spread of COVID, we immediately send them back to their country of origin? What do you think that person's answer will be? Do you support that policy? Do you think that person behind the mask would say yes or no, they support that policy? Maybe if you didn't say Trump, let's leave Trump out of it, but do you suppose, if you didn't say the word Trump, but you just explained the policy as I did, why it was there, and that there's a discussion right now about doing away with it, what do you think? I mean, I know this is hypothetical, but what do you think that person who still wears the mask today would say to that?
I don't think they'd be able to answer you directly. I think they'd be on to something. They'd think you were trying to bait them, don't you think?
I don't know. I would think that if COVID is one of their chief concerns, and I'm not mocking. I swear I'm not. I know it may sound like I am. I'm really not. If you're still wearing a mask today, I assume that you live with a still very real frontal lobe presence of mind. COVID is still very much right there in your face every day if you're still wearing a mask.
Yeah.
Is my get fair?
Yeah.
So with that in mind, if I came to you and said, we have a policy in this country that says under COVID concerns, we're going to deport people that break into the country illegally on site because we're concerned about the spread of COVID and not being able to control it right now. Naturally, we can't check on the health and vaccination status of people that break into the country. We can't vaccinate people breaking into the country, so we're sending them home. That's what's called Title 42. Do you support that? I think the mask lady or the mask guy at Wawa says, oh, yeah, I support that. We got to stop the spread, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how you wouldn't. If you live in fear of catching this thing, how could you support the idea of thousands of Guatemalans breaking into the country with God knows what? How could you support it? What sense would that make?
No, that would be common ground with a, you know, I want to say leftist because I think that they are still the ones holding on to the masks the most. So that would be common ground.
That's precisely right. And so when Politico writes this hysterical story this morning, COVID creeps ever closer to Biden, then how do you explain Biden doing away with Title 42? They're writing about the Obama visit to the White House this week. Again, like when it's so funny, it surrounds these big events. The Amy Coney Barrett Trump meeting at the White House. Remember, that's the one that Christie was in. And then he got COVID, and then he ran around television bellyaching about how irresponsible the Trump White House was. And we got the Zapruder film. There was a diorama or something in USA Today that had little dotted lines from the COVID-infected person, and then here was Christie standing over here, and here was Amy Coney Barrett standing here, and they had little graphics tracing where the germs might have flowed, and Trump was in the room. Remember that?
Oh, we had so many good analogies to that. We had the Madden board. We had the game of Clue. Just like, John was in the kitchen with the candlestick.
That's right. That's right. The Secretary of Agriculture in the East Room with, with the lead pipe. So we're back to it now. So Obama comes to town, and they have this big event where Grandpa's completely ignored. Cacklebridges completely ignores him. The whole room completely ignores him. Even COVID has ignored him. COVID is in the room and ignores Biden. That's how insignificant this, air quote, president is. Sloppy Choppers has it. She's kissing all over Biden. She's kissing all over Obama. They've got video. They're studying this yesterday, the video of the kissing. People running around air kissing, hugging, kissing. Now, we know Pelosi was carrying at this hour. Now, watch this video as she air kisses Kamala, as she air kisses Barack. And what's so funny is Biden doesn't have it. So even COVID ignored him. But my point is, why are they writing about this with hysterics? All these people are supposedly pumped full of 5 and 6 doses of Pfizer. Why are we writing about it like there's a terrorist in the White House with a gun?
I think it's intentional. I mean, I know, you know, it's intentional. But what I'm saying is they've ignored the Gavin Newsoms and the mayor of Austin and Lori Lightfoot. They've ignored all of that, yet honed in on the Amy Coney Barrett event during COVID, the height of COVID. Now, all of a sudden, they're focusing on this for a specific reason.
For as long as Biden remains uninfected, there are few signs that the circulating virus will prompt any scale back of his schedule. The president is fully vaccinated and boosted and has relished the opportunity to mingle with the broader public. Relished the opportunity. I don't know about that. There's also some messaging value, Biden officials noted, in demonstrating how people can go about their lives with minimal disruption, even if COVID isn't fully defeated. That is, as long as government has the resources to keep up its vigilance. So Politico finally concludes that you can, in fact, go on about your daily lives as long as government is allowed to remain vigilant. Even though this is a story about how government can't do jack excrement to stop the spread of this virus, it's important that we continue to empower government and government resources to keep up their vigilance. Yet we're doing away with Title 42 at the border, which was done very specifically to maintain and contain the spread of the virus at the border by illegals breaking in. We're doing away with that. So you see them?
Yeah.
You see how these, in 1 week, literally collide? It's ridiculous. And media should be ashamed of itself for not making the connection that I'm making here. On the very week we're doing away with Title 42, which keeps people contained and out of our country because we don't know their health status, and it was done to prevent the spread of COVID, on the very week we're doing away with that, they write pieces like, as long as government has the resources to keep up vigilance, we can go about our lives with minimal disruption. Well, what vigilance is the government keeping up at the border? We're scaling back and doing away with government vigilance at the border. This irritates me. It's more than just hypocrisy. It's outright stupid. And what makes me most mad, there are people in this country who live with a fear, still a very real fear of COVID. And stories like this about the president, COVID creeping ever closer to Biden, are meant to scare the hell out of them. Then they say, but, you know, look, there's some messaging value in this. You can go on about your lives. As long as you've had all your proper 5 and 6 dozen shots, you can go on about your lives with minimal disruption. Even if we haven't fully defeated COVID. You can't fully defeat COVID, a-holes. You can't fully defeat. For anybody that doesn't know this and still needs to hear it, we will never defeat COVID. Never. It's a thing that is here forever. I don't know who needs to hear that, but let Uncle Chris be the one to break it to you today. Over at Town Hall, where I contribute from time to time, Jonathan Emord, friend of the show, constitutional law attorney, author of the book The Authoritarians, Their Assault on Individual Liberty, the Constitution, and Free Enterprise from the 19th Century to the Present. He's written a piece called The Constitution Creates a Republic, Not a Democracy. It's interesting these days. The Democrats love to shout about an assault on our democracy. Our democracy, our very democracy is at stake. And Mr. Emord decided, I think, I don't know if that was the reason, but he decided to take the opportunity to, let's talk about definitions. What is democracy and what are we actually? A representative republic. He joins us now. And Mr. Emord, thanks a lot for your time, first of all, this morning. Hi.
Oh, you're welcome. It's an honor to be with you.
So let's start with the more obvious stuff. I assume your skin must crawl at the idea of, and not as a person, but just as a justice with the judicial philosophy and temperament that she has, Ketanji Brown Jackson being confirmed yesterday as the next Supreme Court justice. I'm sure as a constitutional scholar and attorney, that must be pretty upsetting to you.
Yes, it is. It's unfortunate to see people who fail to apprehend, or if they do understand it, they fail to abide by it, the central purpose of being a Supreme Court justice, which is, as Alexander Hamilton explained, is to be a guardian of the Constitution. And those who think that the Constitution is such a malleable instrument that any contemporary problem can be resolved by resort more to politics than to understanding the intended meaning that the Founding Fathers gave to a particular provision and issue, pose a dire threat, have for decades, and to our underlying conception that the Constitution, as the Declaration of Independence anticipates in its second paragraph, is a compact with the people. The people are responsible for the powers in the Constitution because we have consented to them. And when there is a change in the allocation of power by judicial determination or act of a usurper in government, our rights are directly affected because the Constitution, first and foremost, is designed to protect individual liberty. And the means by which change is to take place is through Article 5, the amendment process. When it happens through fiat or its usurpation of power, it's a real problem. And George Washington anticipated this when in his inaugural address he said, "Let there be no change by usurpation, for though in one instance it may be an instrument of good, it is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed." And that has not set into a lot of the contemporary constitutional scholars and jurists, sadly.
And this is why, Jonathan Emord, when the justice cannot define or is not willing to define or expound on natural rights codified in our founding documents, when she, as a concept, won't embrace it or can't or won't define it or acknowledge it, that's chilling to me. We talked with our friend Annie McCarthy about this, too. That's so fundamental. I mean, if you don't understand that there are just certain inalienable rights gifted us by God that cannot be governed or taken or legislated or ruled away, if you don't embrace that as a justice, for heaven's sakes, boy, Katie, bar the door.
No question about it. If you don't have an understanding of natural rights, you don't understand the foundational principles of this country, because without question, the Constitution, particularly the Bill of Rights and the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, are designed to secure natural rights, that is, pre-political rights. If you have no understanding of that, then you buy into this liberal narrative. Actually, it's a socialist narrative derived from, ultimately, from Friedrich Hegel in the early 19th century, that The state is the source of our rights, not God. And the Founding Fathers squarely understood, as did Locke, upon whom they based much of their political philosophy, that a just government depends upon protection of pre-political rights, which come from God, not from the state. If the state is the source of our rights, we end up with a Canadian scenario, much like Trudeau was able to abuse his people so much like a tyrant, because in Canada, as in the UK, the idea has been that your rights are derived from Parliament, from the state. That is a serious problem, as we see with the crackdown on the Freedom Convoy. You can be protesting peacefully, and yet Parliament can, for political reasons, decide that you have no rights, or give to the prime minister dictatorial power to take away your rights. That's the same kind of environment that the Democrat Party and liberal jurists in this country would like to have us have here. And it has been a huge blessing for us that instead the Founding Fathers were so vocal, so clear, that our rights don't come from the state, but come from God.
And it has been irksome over the years, as I also mentioned with Andy this week. It was something that the late, great Rush Limbaugh always rightly focused on under the Obama administration. Obama famously talked about the Constitution as a charter of negative liberties. Like, in other words, progressives have always complained that our founding documents were documents designed to, as you just said, state what the government could not do, that there were limits between the government and the people. And that really, at its core, is what bugs progressives. They can't stand that our founding limits what they want to do to us.
And they violate those strictures with impunity, and that's the real problem of the modern era. Really, since the progressive era in this country, it has been that out of disdain for the Constitution's limits on power, they have actually created an extra constitutional government, one never allowed for by the Constitution, indeed prohibited by it, which is the administrative state. When three-quarters of all of our laws are now the product of the unelected heads of the bureaucratic agencies possessed of legislative, executive, and judicial power combined, they satisfy what James Madison described as the very definition of tyranny. And that is because the judge is also the prosecutor. The party that makes the laws is not your representative. You have no say-so in the process, and yet three-quarters of our federal law is that form, comes from that really totalitarian or authoritarian system, and not from our republic. So we already are very far down the socialist rabbit hole, and they are taking full advantage of that when the president, for example, compels every employee in a company, 100 or more, to be vaccinated or to be tested weekly. He's usurping legislative power beyond that which he has under the Constitution, of course, but he's also doing it through what? Through executive agencies, through the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. That, fortunately, was held unconstitutional, but nonetheless, every one of these episodes where someone who has no spatial and temporal awareness but a strong affinity for socialism like President Biden can very readily keep pushing the envelope, changing the precedent, and moving us ever closer to that day, which they hope they will achieve, when the state runs virtually every aspect of our lives. It has done so in business, for sure, and it is largely trying to do it to us personally, as we see with these mandates.
Jonathan E. Mord with us, constitutional law attorney, author of the book The Authoritarians, on this very subject. If it interests you, this book is one of the best you'll read on the subject. To your point, this shot mandate is probably one of the most obvious examples of what you're talking about. And I would ask you about a couple of who I think we consider maybe more traditional Republican/conservative or originalist jurists on the Supreme Court, I heard it explained to me, and I don't know if you agree or not, that a couple of them, because they come from the executive branch, or they're, I don't know if you want to say empathetic or familiar with the executive branch, even they, not just as progressive appointees, but even some of the Republican appointees, are inclined to defer to the executive branch on things like the shot mandate. So we have this ruling yesterday. Federal appeals court upholds Biden vaccine mandate for federal workers. We know that a couple of the justices, Roberts and Kavanaugh, said that CMS workers still had to take the shot. So what I'm getting at is, even some Republican-appointed justices out there seem to believe that these executive branch people, or if you work for the government, that you should have a different set of standards applied to you than those of us in the private sector. That's, to me, that's worrisome, but that's also something to be mindful of as more and more of us go to work for the government.
That's right. I think that there really is no sound ideological way to distinguish the decision against the employer mandate and the decision in favor of the CMS mandates. You really can't. It strains credulity in order to try to create some distinction for the very point that you're raising, which is that it is fundamentally a violation of individual liberty, but it's also fundamentally, in this case, they didn't go down that far, a violation of the separation of powers that Congress itself has not made clear, either in the CMS context or in this OSHA context, with the emergency temporary standard, that there is any power delegated for the purpose of authorizing the mandates. And so it violates the separation of powers. Why they chose to go through Herculean efforts to glob on multiple provisions of regulation and statutory provisions in the CMS context to sort of say, by analogy to the privacy context, essentially, that there is this penumbra created of rights for the federal government, of powers for the federal government, to invade your right, personal liberty right. But that kind of loose construction is the real threat to our liberties, and that is the very thing that we have to try to prevent. It is a usurpation of power by the court, really. And what's more important, I think, for us all to understand, the Founding Fathers understood the delegated powers in the Constitution, the repositories of powers in Article 1, 2, and 3, that those were vested and that they could not be delegated away to any other entity or division or department. And that arose from John Locke. There was no redelegation authorized. That when a constitution or when a charter is adopted by the people, as was ours, the vested powers are vested, may not be redelegated. Otherwise, the limits on power are immediately breached, as is the case of the administrative state. So the very delegation of power actually at root to the administrative agencies of vested powers, like the power to make the law, which is exclusively vested in Congress. Mm-hmm. Giving that away to agencies, Congress has violated the Constitution fundamentally, has destroyed the very separation of powers and the non-delegation doctrine, which is essential to protect the Constitution's integrity and therefore our rights.
Yeah, it's... It frustrates me greatly that there's an attitude that if you work for the government, you immediately become a ward of the state, ergo you just do whatever they tell you, and we don't, you know, laws, rules, Congress, whatever their role in it, be damned. You work for the state, now you're a product of the state. That's scary. First of all, I don't think our founders could ever have imagined how gigantic, you know, what a monolith our government would become. You know, they would never imagine Washington, D.C. being so full of bureaucratic buildings, blocks and blocks and blocks of these cabinet departments and thousands of employees in each. I think that would make them sick anyway. But
not at all.
Said,
I mean, they really couldn't recognize that Thomas Jefferson, with a very skeletal administrative staff as president of the United States, already was talking about how government had become parasitic and was sucking the lifeblood out of the country. They were appalled at the existence of power at their time and the abuse of it. Jefferson also said, "I am not a friend of a very energetic government. It is always oppressive."
These lessons have
never been learned by modern jurists of the left. They have disdain for them. They inherit that disdain actually all the way back to the very origins of the administrative state in America, to the 1800s, the late 1800s.
Yeah, and yet you'll hear a lot of people say that a government job's the place. In fact, I just overheard it the other day in conversation. Somebody said, boy, you get yourself one of those jobs. It was somebody talking about working for the Social Security Administration. Hey, you get one of those, you can't ever be fired, said someone over dinner. And I just thought to myself, boy, isn't that what a lot of people think about joining the administrative state? You know, that you're there and you're entrenched for life. But the problem with that is, of course, whenever the administrative state decides they want you to do something, oh, you'll do it, or else, is basically where we are today.
Right. It is a sad reality of our time that the federal government seems to grow and grow and grow. I came in the Reagan administration. We were intent on getting rid of the Federal Trade Commission and substantially gutting the Federal Communications Commission such that it would not have any influence over content or structure of the media, allowing
Amen.
A marketplace. We largely succeeded in the FCC context, but did not get rid of the FCC and replace it with a property rights approach, which is what I advocated in my book, Freedom, Technology, and the First Amendment. But Dr. Coase from the University of Chicago advocated that earlier. In the case of the FTC, it is a grotesque, abusive agency that has escaped the noose during the Reagan years, protected by Congress, and has become a wrecking ball that is going through the economy, selectively destroying many innocent parties and businesses, completely obliterating them by a very draconian regime that is entirely one-sided. The administrative state has revived the courts of Star Chamber and High Commission from England that the founding fathers were so intent to prevent from having established here. That's why we have a prohibition against general warrants in the Constitution, which are warrants issued by administrators, their attorneys general or officers of the court, but not by the court itself, and that have a roving power to seize anything that may be brought in to create charges as opposed to be the product of probable cause. That power is in the administrative state today, and it violates the prohibition on general warrants. It has been there for decades. People who are victims of administrative courts and agencies realize all too well that they are guilty until they're proven innocent, and
yes,
that the agencies can rove through all manner of their personal papers and economic transactions to find something, just anything, that might give rise to charges.
Jonathan, before we pivot to your piece at Town Hall, and I do want to do that before I let you go, are you bearish, bullish? What's your attitude about the administrative state today, specific to our Department of Justice? So many people listening to us right now, and for all the reasons you've laid out, understand that there is a two-tiered system of justice, and a lot of us feel like after we've lived through what we watched with the Clinton administration, or I should say, well, the Clinton candidacy, and all that's come out with the Clinton campaign of 2016, what we know now with the Hunter Biden laptop affair, the way Donald Trump was you know, treated, surveilled, there were such violations through DOJ, while in other instances heads were turned and things were ignored. And one wonders, can you ever restore a sense of justice that the American people will trust? Are we too far down the rabbit hole now? Can we come back from this or no?
I think we definitely can come back from this, but it's going to take a rude awakening at the Department of Justice, the FBI, and in the administrative agencies. We're going to have to really fundamentally clean house, and we're also going to have to change the jurisdictional nature of these entities so that they cannot abuse power in the way in which they have. we have a system presently of unequal justice in our country. Equal justice under law is a fundamental principle, the absence of which is tyrannical. We have a system of political justice where people in issues that are politically favored are ignored, whether they are Antifa or BLM rioters, or whether it's the Hunter Biden laptop and the President of the United States' deep involvement in that corruption, completely ignored or put on the back burner to such an extent that it does not arise to the level of urgency and need for immediate treatment that obviously it has. Yet individuals with no evidence whatsoever to support their charge of President Trump's corruption were nonetheless able to use all the instrumentalities of the government, even the judiciary, FICA courts, to their great advantage in pursuing a witch hunt. And indeed, that is a grotesque example of the perversion of the rule of law for political ends. If we don't correct that course, if we don't rout out all of those who are responsible and punish them appropriately under the law, we will have a legacy that will be resorted to again and again by parties of both sides to the great ruination of this country. And it's a cancer on the state. It's a cancer on our legacy of liberty and equal justice, and we have to address it. We have to do it, and there are many people dedicated to that end. I think after 2022, the midterms, if indeed the Republicans take the House and maybe also the Senate, I think we're going to see some serious changes taking place in all of these areas. Will they do enough? That's the question. They must.
Yes, they must. I hope they consult with you, Jonathan E. Moore, constitutional law attorney, author of an important book called The Authoritarians. And we will have you back, but you've covered a lot of the themes that are in your piece, and I do hope people read it from a very, very learned guy on the difference, and there is a distinction between throwing around the term, we're a democracy, and we're a republic. The Constitution creates a republic, not a democracy, he writes. I hope you'll read it at townhall.com from Jonathan E. Moore. That's E-M-O-R-D. Professor, thank you for your time, and I will have you back soon.
Thanks so much, Chris. I really value you, Chris. Thank you.
I absolutely adore that Elon Musk owns 10% of Twitter. It just tickles me to no end. You see, yesterday he tweeted, looking forward to working with whoever the guy is that runs Twitter. I don't even know his name. Don't care to learn his name. But he said, looking forward to working with whoever he is and the rest of Twitter to, he said, improve it. And so several Twitter employees have quit now because of it. And I just, it makes me, I don't know, I'm just happy about it. It's a bit of good news. Yeah, Washington Post running a piece yesterday saying Elon Musk's Twitter investment could be bad news for free speech. Tuesday morning, WaPo publishing an analysis titled Elon Musk's Twitter investment, bad news for free speech. Musk tweaked Washington Post owner Jeff Bezos before firing back, WaPo always good for a laugh. The author of the Tuesday opinion piece that triggered Musk's always good for a laugh response was a guy called Timothy O'Brien, senior columnist for Bloomberg Opinion, who wrote derisively, Elon Musk just bought a $3 billion stake in Twitter, Inc., because when you're the world's richest human, you can toss billions around like poker chips. This might be just another piece of performance art from Musk. He does know who he collects a check from, right? This Tim O'Brien? A guy just like Musk, Jeff Bezos. You want to talk about throwing billions around for performance art? Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post. Could you think of a bigger waste? If I told you, here's $1 billion, I want you to invest some of it, and you can only pick between one of these two entities, the Washington Post or Twitter, which one do you spend money on?
Oof.
WaPo or Twitter? You can only invest in one of the two of them. You can become the majority shareholder of one of the two of them. Which one do you want? Twitter or Washington Post?
Probably Twitter. I'm safer in the technology world, I think.
Of course. It's not even close. Twitter's the investment. Washington Post is so yesterday. And yet Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post. Performance art indeed. That's total ego. Jeff Bezos is an old guy who thinks the Washington Post is still the destination for people who get their news. No, it's not. This guy, Tim O'Brien, said, so maybe we should take Musk's Twitter investment as more of the same from the guy who has pondered the meaning of life while sipping whiskey and smoking weed during a podcast and once mysteriously claimed he had funding secured to take Tesla Inc. private. Then he confessed his real fear. Quote, I suspect there's something more serious informing Musk's decision to invest in Twitter, even if he revels in buffoonery. Maybe he wants to bring Twitter to heel. Folks, the reason this is important, and the reason the Washington Post is so upset, and Jeff Bezos and his minions are upset, and people are quitting Twitter, I don't know Elon Musk at all. I have no sense of who the man is. I don't guess he's probably some sort of rock-ribbed conservative. But he has been a victim, like so many of the rest of us, of the growing cancel culture and the growing censorship. He recognizes where a lot of people get their information. And he's decided to take majority ownership of one of those vessels to try to rein it in and make it, I suspect, a more even playing field. And for that, the American left hates his guts. All he's think of this. Think of why they're hating on him so much. Why are they so aggressively editorializing that he's, you know, some fanciful burnout and stoner? Because he dares restore a voice to Twitter for people that have been kicked out, including the ex-president of the United States. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not just, it really isn't a small matter. I don't bellyache and whine about my social media. I don't, ultimately I don't care. It has served us as a show well for a lot of years in communicating with you. I've enjoyed it. I've learned from it. It's a great way to interact. It's a great way to get instantaneous feedback. It's a great source of information from people that I followed and enjoyed reading. So I valued it as a show resource for a long time. And it's bothered me operationally greatly that Twitter has decided that people like me are not people that other people should consume or are dangerous or whatever. I've never been flatly censored from Twitter, but I've told you before, it's very, very clear. And, you know, there's been plenty of analysis and study done on it that people like me, and it's not just me, I don't mean to make it out to be about me, there are lots of people like me who Twitter flagged, I don't know how long ago, it seemed like it was really ramped up during the Trump era. They decided that Trump and anybody who was supportive of Trump, you know, Donald Trump Jr., the Trump campaign, I interacted a lot with him on Twitter. And basically, you were guilty by association if you did that. And so as soon as they kicked Donald Trump off Twitter, as soon as Trump was no longer president, you could see where Twitter got a hold of accounts like mine. And again, not just me, so don't misunderstand this as me whining about it. But they took lots of accounts like mine, and they either purged them of a lot of followers or algorithmically rigged it. And I don't know what I'm talking about exactly when I say that. You guys in IT or programming, maybe you understand it. I don't, and I don't need to. I'm not going to get down in the weeds on it. But basically, the way to understand it and think of it is, and Facebook does this too, and YouTube certainly does this, they have the ability to, if you're flagged or identified as someone that they don't like, or pushing points of view or speech they don't like, they don't have to outright ban you. I don't know that everybody totally understands this or how it works, but they can basically set it up so that what you write and what you post, while they don't ban you, while they don't cancel you and take you down, while it may look to you like your account is up and operable and working, they can control how many people see it. So you may think you have thousands and thousands of followers and an audience of thousands and thousands, and when you post something, thousands and thousands are seeing it. Twitter, and I don't know how they do it, doesn't really matter how they do it, it's unquestionably true what they do, is they can govern the things you post in such a way to make sure that a very limited few see it, that there's very little traffic. And so they've been playing that game for a while. And, you know, for those that they really deem egregious, they'll just throw them off the platform altogether. I've told you in over a year and a half, almost 2 years, my Twitter following hasn't grown a bit. That's something else they can do. No matter how many people follow you, they can set your Twitter following to whatever it is they've deemed reasonable or whatever they're going to allow and tolerate, and they will not allow. I mean, I've watched it. It's amazing. I'll pick up like, you know, a few hundred or a thousand followers in a day, and then the next day they're all gone. And it's right back to, it's like a water tank that fills up and gets so high, and then somebody just, you know, opens the drain at the bottom to drain it back down to the level that's allowed. So that's the kind of stuff, and I'm only talking to you about this because I know a lot of you don't tweet, and I know a lot of you are not even really particularly interested in Twitter, but it is a powerful, powerful communication tool. It is real-time communication. It was kind of considered a Wild West joke of a thing years ago, something that I even mocked. I refused to ever participate in it. I actually launched a campaign years ago called Real Men Don't Tweet. I refused to even say the word. I thought it was so stupid. And at first it was used as really, you know, Eddie would tweet things like, I'm having eggs for breakfast. Look. You know, and would take pictures of his eggs. And I used to have such contempt for it because I was like, I like Eddie, but I don't care what he's eating at breakfast. And I was like, what? Why is this such a stupid, narcissistic? And people were using it that way. And then conservatives in particular got smart with it and started figuring out how to use it. And they realized, wow, this is really a huge way to communicate quickly with one another and build networks and say, hey, you know, I'm here at the White House and, you know, I see this going on right now. Or, hey, did you read this? And it tore down so many walls. And again, that media estate who hated talk radio and hated Fox News after that really hated Twitter. Because Twitter was like talk radio and Fox News on steroids. You didn't have to wait for a talk show that you liked. You didn't have to wait for, you know, your favorite show, Tucker or Hannity. It was all day. Twitter became like a 24/7 news stream for me. And I became kind of addicted to it, as a matter of fact. And I didn't want to, I was constantly looking at it thinking, I'm going to miss something. But then Twitter figured that out. And they realized how dangerous it was. And it's really dangerous when you're trying to drag the old bones of Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden across the finish line, and the country has no appetite for them. So what do you have to do? You have to control the message. Elon Musk recognizes the power in this. So while I know this may seem like some sort of eccentric billionaire throwing his money around and maybe throwing it down the rabbit hole of some, you know, communications tool that you don't use and you think is sort of a millennial thing and you roll your eyes at it, I wouldn't dismiss this as insignificant because the Washington Post clearly understands why this is a threat. There are a lot of people inside Twitter that are quitting today because Elon Musk is now a majority shareholder and he promises that he's going to restore Twitter and make it better. One of the first things he could do, and I'd love to see him do, is put Donald Trump back on it. Would that not be cool? As majority owner of Twitter, I hereby declare Donald Trump's Twitter account restored. Now, I know he's launched Truth Social, which some of you might be on. I'm on, but it still ain't Twitter. That would be huge. So, this guy at the Washington Post concluding, Musk probably isn't in it for the money. He's in it to make a point. And he's in it to scare Twitter's management. Somebody who's complained that his free speech is being chilled should perhaps be sensitive to those nuances, but that would assume that Musk is more of a philosopher than a bully. You get that? You see the irony in this? A guy at the Washington Post is complaining that a billionaire bought a company and he's the bully for promising to open up channels of speech. He's a bully. One explanation for Musk's sensitivity might be found in his libertarian leanings, says the Washington Post. Belated efforts by social media platforms to constrain some of the most virulent forms of political propaganda have raised the hackles of that crowd, along with far-rightists and Trumpistas. So you see, again, they get to control what is virulent and what is political propaganda. And isn't it nice to be in charge of that? When you get to determine what is propaganda, when you get to determine what is virulent, well, then I guess that means any conservative with whom you disagree. From Elon Musk to little talk show hosts like Chris Stigall. And that's why a billionaire throwing around his money at something like Twitter is so threatening to them and so exciting to me. I hope he makes good on it. I'll be watching what he does at Twitter with great interest. Not because I mean to suggest you should pour your heart and soul into Twitter or that you'll ever use it or maybe even care about it, but the significance of it can't be ignored.
The Chris Stigall Show Podcast.